From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. And here's President Obama speaking to a room full of journalists this week at a luncheon of the American Society of Newspaper Editors.
I guess another way of thinking about this is, and this bears on your reporting, I think that there is oftentimes the impulse to suggest that if the two parties are disagreeing, then they're equally at fault and the truth lies somewhere in the middle. An equivalence is presented, which reinforces, I think, people's cynicism about Washington generally.
Barack Obama, President, Commander-in-Chief, Journalism Professor? The luncheon is a tradition that has attracted every American president since Coolidge to speak and field questions. What made this week's iteration unusual was that Obama got into the nitty-gritty of a topic dear to our hearts here at Media Criticism Central, and that is false equivalency, also known as he said, she said reporting. The Atlantic's James Fallows wrote about Obama's exhortation. He says that, in fact, the press has gotten a bit better when it comes to this kind of reporting.
The main case in which we've seen the press sort of rise to that challenge, I think, was with the birtherism controversy of maybe 2 years ago, where for a while it was reported as, some people say, President Obama was not born in America. President Obama denies the charge. Eventually, the press began saying the charge is not true.
Is it possible that in the midst of a campaign, the president's desire for the press to dig in to the various claims is going to redound to his detriment?
Yes, and I think the president was in a dilemma which he himself even seemed conscious of, because in the sort of lighthearted beginning to his speech, he was saying, we don't want you and the press to be reveling in all these gaffes and misstatements, unless, of course, it's the other guy, in which case, good job. But I think that probably he was in the grips of an uncontrollable frustration. I say uncontrollable in that other Democratic presidents feel as if they have to give vent to their feeling that the press really should be approaching things in a different way, even as the conscious parts of their brain realize that this really won't do any good.
Let me ask you a question about psychology. It seems to me that in the last few years, the press actually is doing a better job of getting to the heart of claims as opposed to simply repeating them stenographically. Is it possible that as a result of being lectured to by the president, that some news organizations will react, this guy's not going to tell me how to do my job, and actually kind of backslide?
It is possible there could be this backfiring effect, because nobody in the press wants to be seen as doing a politician's bidding, even if objectively we're doing something like that. And you saw a very ironic consequence, or at least sequel, to the president's speech from the Associated Press itself the day after the speech.
So in fulfillment of the president's request, they vetted his claim.
Yes. So he was saying that they were reporting on the individual mandate as some wacky, radical, anti-constitutional idea, when in fact it was originally a Republican proposal. Romney had enacted it in Massachusetts.
And the AP said that the president was being disingenuous because he characterized the health care package as very centrist, but that the individual mandate was explicitly a left-wing notion.
Which, of course, was exactly the opposite.
Because the president's original position was for the public option, also known as single payer, which would have been more, I almost hesitate to use the word, but socialistic in nature, like Medicare. And going to the individual mandate was a move to the right, no?
Yes. And so there was a kind of fabulous triple whammy, five-dimensional aspect to this fact check by the AP. So on the one hand, they were doing a fact check the day after President Obama asked for fact check. So that might look as if they were doing his bidding. On the other hand, they'd been doing these fact checks for a number of years. So they were sort of anticipating his objection there. And yet, for the final backflip, they got the facts exactly wrong.
It's like a hall of mirrors, Jim. Let me play another piece of tape from the president's speech.
So, as all of you are doing your reporting, I think it's important to remember that the positions I'm taking now on the budget and a host of other issues, if we had been having this discussion 20 years ago, or even 15 years ago, would have been considered squarely centrist positions. What's changed is the center of the Republican Party.
Do you think that ideas that were once dismissed as fringe will be called out by the press according to the president's wishes?
I think that it's hard for the press to operate in circumstances like these. And here's an example from recent history. Looking backwards, less than 4 years, almost everybody, including a large number of Republican Party strategists, can say that Sarah Palin was not a plausible nominee for the vice presidency, that she was a drag on the McCain ticket, that she was not really qualified, etc. It was very hard for reporters to say that at the time for fear of being seen as a partisan or doing the bidding of the Democratic Party, etc., etc. So I will predict to you here and now that a year from now, 2 years from now, reporters will easily say that in the 2012 Republican primaries, the party really moved to the fringe. And a lot of ideas that just didn't have any sort of centrist plausibility were becoming the central part of the party's platform. While we're in real time, it's hard for, quote, objective, unquote, journalists to say that within the conventions of our business. And that's the struggle that we all are dealing with for these next couple of months.
Jim, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. We've been hearing a lot about gas prices lately, and what we've been hearing about especially is how threatening those prices are to Barack Obama's chances for re-election. Mitt Romney has hit the president hard on the issue.
Do you believe President Obama is to blame for high gas prices?
Well, there's no question but that when he ran for office, he said he wanted to see gasoline prices go up.
And the press has made clear that the electorate is influenced by prices at the pump.
Mitt Romney may be not able to beat the president, but $5 a gallon gas sure could.
What reporter Adam Davidson wondered was if the conventional wisdom is true. In a piece for New York Times Magazine, Davidson explained that gas prices have less effect on Americans' economic behavior than politicians and the press would have us believe.
When prices go up, people don't seem to change their behavior all that much in the short term. The average American spends around $40 on gas a week. About $8 of that is spent on their commute to work. About $13 of it is spent on recreational stuff, going to restaurants, driving around. The rest is spent on what you could call required errands, you know, taking your kids to school or soccer practice. So you would think that if gas prices really were this painful, awful thing, that when the prices went up, people would cut down on that $13 a week in discretionary driving. And you just don't see that, which makes me doubt that it's going to have such a huge effect on the election.
When the prices of other commodities go up, you mentioned in your piece corn and copper. We don't actually have to go to the cash register and pay for the copper and corn. With gasoline, we are standing there watching those dials spin and getting to $50, $60, $70, and it just feels worse.
Something that really strikes me about commodity prices is just how buffered we in America are from them. The typical African or many people in South America or throughout Asia, they buy food as a commodity. They don't buy, you know, some packaged food product, they buy a big sack of rice or they buy a big sack of corn. And they are very aware day by day, hour by hour, how those prices swing up and down based on global market conditions. We don't do that. Most of the things we buy, we're not buying the commodity. Just like, you know, there's been huge upswings in copper and magnesium and all sorts of weird minerals that nobody has ever heard of.
There's no Romney commercial that says the magnesium prices are skyrocketing and the president has sat on his hands.
Right. It would make about as much economic sense to say, why isn't the president doing something about copper prices, magnesium prices? The way gas prices are determined has very, very little to do with anything the president can do day to day. That's such an obvious, glaring fact, but it seems like something that we business and financial journalists could really hammer home a little more intensely.
Well, maybe it would help if the press had a better grasp on supply and demand. There seems to be an assumption that if America reduces its dependency on foreign oil by drilling in the Gulf of Mexico or piping in oil and gas from Canada, it would lower prices because we are less dependent on foreign oil.
It's not that simple at all. We've had a huge experiment in this exact issue. We used to import around 60% of our crude oil from overseas. Now we import around 45%. So we're dramatically more energy independent. And the price of gasoline has gone up. Gasoline is a very dynamic market. You need to think an awful lot about China and India and the overall macroeconomy of the world, refining capacity. Anytime anyone identifies one cause for gas prices, you know that they're either lying or selling you something, or they just don't understand the market at all.
You know, we've just had a conversation about the president appearing at the American Society of News Editors, wagging a scolding finger about how they cover politics. Maybe it would be better if you appeared at the American Society of News Editors and wagged a finger about what a lousy job they do explaining the very basics of economics, especially in this gas price issue.
I think there are statements that are just such outliers. They don't need to be respected. Why don't we start every story by saying, Mitt Romney said something that is completely untrue and unsupported by any evidence? In response, President Obama said something that was true or not true and is or isn't supported by evidence. I do wish that there was more of an effort at the deep explaining. Every consumer of the media needs to understand where the global economy is going. If they're going to decide what kind of job they're going to have, where they're going to live, what kind of house they're going to buy, what kind of car they're going to buy, what their kids should major in college. And what this financial crisis revealed, and it's just as true in oil and energy, is we journalists as a profession are not prepared, and we need to be prepared. I can understand why we weren't, but enough already. This is one of our big, big jobs.
Adam, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Adam Davidson is a reporter for Planet Money on NPR. He wrote a piece about gas prices for the New York Times Magazine. Coming up, is that a leg of lamb? Why, no, it's the first cell phone. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In 2010, a blogger named Crystal Cox started posting vicious attacks online about a bankruptcy trustee named Kevin Padrick. Padrick sued Cox for defamation, and last November, a federal court in Oregon found her liable, whereupon a jury awarded $2.5 million to Padrick and his company, Obsidian Finance Group. During the case, Cox tried to invoke the Shield Law that protects journalists from having to reveal their sources. But Judge Marco Hernandez wrote that Cox did not count as a journalist and that the Shield Law did not apply to her. Naturally, seeing one of their own denied journalist status raised the hackles of the blogging world. But as they dug deeper into her behavior, Cox's defenders found that this story wasn't quite as simple as it appeared. More on that coming up. Meantime, the Electronic Frontier Foundation worried that Judge Hernandez was dangerously overreaching. The EFF's Trevor Tim says that the ruling against Cox set an uncomfortable precedent that could have far-reaching effects on all bloggers. Trevor, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me on.
This all started when Crystal Cox began blogging on various domains about a lawyer named Kevin Padrick. He was a trustee in a bankruptcy case, and for whatever reason, she decided to target him many times and in many ways. Can you tell me about the stuff that Cox was writing, where, and then what Padrick decided to do?
So Crystal Cox ended up writing hundreds of blog posts under dozens of domain names. For example, one of them was called obsidianfinancesucks.com, which was Padrick's company. And she accused him and his company of tax fraud, being corrupt, paying off media and politicians. She accused them of illegal activities, deceiving the government, money laundering, defamation, harassment, and the list goes on. Padrick sued Cox for these hundreds of blog posts, and the judge ended up throwing out every blog post except for one. And in the end, he found that one particular blog post posted on December 25th, 2010, constituted defamation, and the jury awarded Padrick $2.5 million.
Now, Cox claimed that she could not prove her allegations without burning her sources and that under the Oregon Shield law, those sources were absolutely protected. It's the judge's ruling in that claim that has the Electronic Frontier Foundation worried. How and why?
This was a defamation case, and the Shield law shouldn't apply, and that's where the ruling should have ended. Unfortunately, the judge then opined about who exactly is covered by this Shield law. The Shield statute says that anybody involved in any medium of communication shall be covered by the statute. It gives examples for what a medium of communication is. For example, a newspaper, magazine, book, periodical. And it's not limited to any of these, and the statute explicitly says that. Unfortunately, the judge did limit the Shield statute to somebody who is affiliated with a newspaper or magazine.
How queasy is the EFF to be standing aside Crystal Cox for the larger goal of defending the principle?
Our argument to the court was not about whether Crystal Cox is a journalist at all. It was about the interpretation of the Shield statute, and it was about the precedent this ruling could set for future cases if it was applied to other legitimate journalists. It's very likely that if the judge accepted our reasoning as it pertains to the Shield law and his defamation standard, that the jury would have still came to the same conclusion. Our interest in this case is not about Crystal Cox. It's about protecting all other legitimate journalists who operate online and all other commentators who may not be journalists but own a blog or express their opinion online.
All right, Trevor. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Trevor Tim is a lawyer and an activist for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The EFF's strategy was not to appeal the verdict, but to write an amicus brief on Cox's behalf, seeking a retrial based on Judge Hernandez's rulings. Judge Hernandez denied Cox a new trial, but in a small victory for the EFF, he did clarify his ruling on Cox's journalistic bona fides, making it clear that it was she, not bloggers in general, who cannot claim journalistic protection. That clarification was good enough for First Amendment lawyer Mark Randazza, who has a unique perspective on this case, being both a First Amendment expert and one of Cox's online targets. He says Cox had asked him to represent her pro bono in an appeal, but after she became angry with him for reaching out to opposing counsel to come up with a solution amenable to both sides, Cox began an online campaign against Randazza.
She sent me an email saying, by the way, I registered a domain name with your name in it, and I'm wondering if you know of anybody who wants a really good search engine reputation manager. The implication seemed pretty clear to me. There's this long line of people that she's decided to focus on, publish crazy screeds about them, and then she offers to take it down if she becomes your PR agent. It would be akin to you doing a hit piece on me and then saying, well, I can be a journalist today, but I can be your public relations agent tomorrow, and if I do that, well, we can clean up all this mess that I made. And I told her I thought that that was unethical and uncalled for, and asked her to give the domain name to me, and she refused and went off on a tear.
Tell me about the tear.
I could go through it and find portions of it that were defamatory. Much of it was opinion, and it was negative opinion, but it's, you know, she thought I was pompous and arrogant, and, well, I mean, that's a requirement to be a member of the bar, I think. She didn't like my tactics. She didn't like me. She had some crazy idea that I didn't respect her because she's a woman. It was just nuts. Now, I'm a First Amendment attorney. I have a really lucky position in life that people can say crazy things about me, and, you know, what do my clients care? My clients are often people who need help because someone's telling them they can't say what they want to say.
The advantages of having clientele in the lunatic fringe. You probably didn't think of that when you started out your practice, but serendipity.
In some ways, it wound up being to my advantage. I always preach this mantra that the cure for bad speech is more speech. And when I get into a defamation case where I'm defending somebody who's been sued for something they've said, I always get this thing thrown at me, and they say, you'd feel differently if it was you. Now it's me to the factor of 10. And it's not just somebody who's saying something bad about me. It's somebody who's saying something bad about me in a really weird Google bomb way that for the first couple of days occupied most of the first page of hits on Google about me. if somebody had come to me and said, should I file a suit over this, I probably would have said maybe. But because it was me, I need to draw that line further down. I'm happy that when I finally got tested, that I passed that test. And then failing to get that reaction from me, she upped the ante. And then she started to target my wife. My wife is just a wonderful person. I mean, she is in her wedding vows to me, she wrote that she would stand like Anita Garibaldi next to me in all my crazy fights. And, you know, God, actually chokes me up to even repeat that. But I thought, wow, she's going to be tested now. I said, I got to tell you something. You've been now dragged into one of my battles. I was stunned at how much it just rolled off her back. She said, I don't really care. So when that didn't have the desired response, then Ms. Cox went after Natalia, who is my 3-year-old daughter. While I considered legal action at that point, I thought, this is the time where I have to tell the story. In telling the story, other people saw that story and said, enough's enough. I knew I had to stand up and say something because the next person is not going to be a First Amendment attorney. The next person might be somebody particularly vulnerable. The next person might actually pay her requested $2,500 a month in quote-unquote reputation service management.
At any point in this siege, did it ever occur to you to call the FBI?
That discussion came up, but I wanted the front line of this to be that the First Amendment works. Even an unsavory person like her has First Amendment rights, and I even still believe in her First Amendment rights. If we're going to believe in the First Amendment, we have to believe in it for the American Nazi Party wanting to march in Skokie, and we have to believe in it for, you know, somebody like her going absolutely crazy anytime somebody doesn't do her will. And if you can withstand that without involving federal authorities, I think you ought to.
Judge Hernandez declined the motion for a new trial, but in his ruling clarified the language about the relationship between bloggers and journalists. And from a First Amendment point of view, are you not satisfied that the record makes sense?
There's a few rough edges in it, but they're very complicated. When people who aren't legally trained look at a court case, there's a tendency to try to simplify it as much as possible. And if you oversimplify it, there are still problems in it. What I didn't like about the initial order is it seemed to create this strict test for whether somebody was a journalist or not, with these 7 factors. You know, one of them being, does somebody have a journalism degree? Well, I have one, but I haven't yet defended a blogger who had one. The new order makes it clear. The court isn't saying bloggers aren't journalists. The court is saying this blogger is no journalist.
Mark, in your darkest moment, when your 3-year-old was being dragged into your own personal First Amendment nightmare, at any point did you come to doubt the sanctity of free speech?
Fortunately, I thought about this before my daughter was born. I talked to a former partner of mine, Jessica Christensen, who has been a real good barometer for my beliefs. And when I need something like this, I talk to her. And I said, doing what I do has been one thing when it's only been me. When I represent these unpopular causes, when I'm standing up for the rights of adult entertainment companies, and I can weather that because this is what I've chosen to do. But now there's an innocent person coming into the world, and she's going to be at school, and the kids are going to learn how to use Google, and are they going to look at her and go, your father's a smut lawyer? And Jessica's advice has always resonated in me, and she said, you know, you have to take care of your family, but part of taking care of your family is showing moral leadership, and this is what you believe in, and this is what you want your family to believe in. When, you know, God forbid, I mean, you know, we all rebel against our parents. So who knows, maybe one day she'll be working for the Department of Justice on the obscenity task force, and I'll be saying, I have no daughter. But until then, I have to live with my daydream that one day she'll be sitting there as my law partner, and we'll be fighting these cases together.
Mark, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Mark Randazza is a First Amendment lawyer, and he blogs at The Legal Satyricon. We reached out to Crystal Cox for comment, and she directed us to the most recent blog post at crystalcox.com. Last Tuesday marked the anniversary of the first public cell phone call. It was in 1973, 10 years before cell phones would become commercially available, and many more years before they would become wildly popular. The caller, now 83, was Martin Cooper, who then worked for Motorola, and who is now credited with being the father of modern cell phone technology. It all started on Fifth Avenue in New York City when Cooper called Joel Engel, his rival at AT&T, to tell Engel that Motorola had won the race and created a working handheld cell phone.
Well, I recall the conversation vividly. I said, hi, Joel, it's Marty. Marty Cooper, you remember me. I'm calling you from a cell phone, but a real cell phone, a personal, handheld, portable cell phone. And there was silence at the other end of the line. I suspect Joel was grinding his teeth. To this day, he doesn't remember that conversation, and that doesn't surprise me.
So I've got to ask you about the scene. You were outside of, I believe, the New York Hilton and standing on the sidewalk with a telephone the size of a leg of lamb. What did the passers-by, what must they have thought?
They were gaping. I couldn't imagine somebody talking on a telephone. You know, this was before not only cell phones, but there weren't cordless phones at that time. As I was talking to this reporter, I stepped out into the street and almost got nailed by a New York taxi. So that was prescient.
Yes, an eerie foreshadowing. It was a while from that first historic phone call that cell phones became widely in use. I guess a lot of it had to do with cell phones work because the signal travels from tower to tower, and there was no such infrastructure in those days. How was the radio signal transmitted?
Well, Bob, we had to create not only a cell phone, but we actually had to build two stations. So we had a station right next to the New York Hilton, and then we had another station somewhere else in Manhattan. So the signal went from my telephone to one of these stations and then into the landline, just the way cellular conversations work today.
Now, it took a while for that infrastructure to be built so that we mere civilians could use this technology. From the point that you made your historic call, was it a smooth journey to pursue this technology?
First of all, we had to create a lot of new technology. That first phone had thousands of parts in it. It was very, very difficult to maintain. So a lot of technology had to be created. The bigger problem was the FCC's problem. They had to select who were going to be the competitors. The FCC didn't actually select the first people until something like 8 years later. There were a lot of naysayers during that period. Not a lot of people believed that this was going to be a huge business.
It's manifest, the benefits to society that cell technology has provided. There's also a downside. What's your greatest satisfaction, and if I may ask also, what's your greatest regret about what you have wrought?
When I hear stories about farmers in remote villages that now know, because of cell phone technology, what the market is for their products in neighboring villages, things of that nature bring great satisfaction to me. When it comes to the problems, people who text while they drive, that's insane. And I just invented a system that will prevent that. So I think we're going to solve that with technology.
If in 1973 someone had said to you that handheld devices would have miniature software apps embedded in them and enable subsistence farmers in Africa to communicate for virtually no cost and people would be watching television on them, would you have looked at them the way the passersby that day looked at you?
We knew that a lot of these things were going to happen, but not in my lifetime. The idea of watching television on your screen, would you believe that Dick Tracy was talking on his wrist radio? And about the time that we came up with a cell phone, finally Dick Tracy had a video phone. So he always stayed a little bit ahead of us.
Earlier in the week when we were arranging this conversation, you left a voicemail message for our producer. And I was wondering if I could just play that for you.
Hi, Chris. Marty Cooper. It's really embarrassing. My cell phone's running out of juice. So if you could call my assistant, Glenna, and give her whatever information I need for tomorrow, and she'll make sure that I take care of it. Talk to you later. Bye now.
Martin Cooper, you're going to run out of battery life? You think you would have had a solution for that?
How embarrassing. The fact is that the concept of finding a charger and plugging things in is another thing that's part of the immaturity of our industry. You ought to be able to take your cell phone and just put it down on the counter when you go to sleep at night and have it charged up when you wake up in the morning. So just an example of how the technology hasn't moved fast enough for me.
Martin, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Martin Cooper is the co-founder of Dyna LLC, which supports new tech companies, and he is the father of modern cell phone technology. Coming up, Reply Girls Part 2. YouTube tries to solve the problem of irrelevant videos. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And now for a few of your letters. Last week, Brooke spoke to Tom Bissell, a writer for the video game magazine Grantland, about the angry response from gamers to the ending of the video game Mass Effect. Our story got some angry responses from gamers as well. While discussing what made the ending of Mass Effect so disappointing, Bissell revealed what happens at the end of another popular game, 2010's Red Dead Redemption. George Dragomanis from Brooklyn wrote, quote, "I've been playing Red Dead Redemption on Xbox 360, and I heard this segment of your show where the ending of the game was discussed. Aren't you familiar with the concept of spoiler alert? WTF? Others were unhappy with the talk of the Mass Effect game's ending. Michael Cook wrote, quote, "I felt it was a little odd you spoiled Red Dead Redemption, but since that game is a few years old, it doesn't matter too much. But Mass Effect has only been out for about 3 weeks." And Andrew wrote, quote, "Many of us avoid discussion of endings because we want to be surprised, for better or worse. The ME3 ending is not yet gamer common knowledge. Thanks for spoiling the ME3 ending on public radio." But still others didn't see much of a problem with the conversation at all. Aaron writes, quote, "Anyone complaining of spoilers in this piece is insane. Who knew that a discussion on the controversy of the ME3 ending would include a discussion about the ending?" On another subject, a few weeks ago, I spoke with Daily Dot writer Fujina Erdig about the phenomenon of reply girls, who've been driving YouTube users crazy with their barrage of nonsensical cleavage-bearing videos.
They reply to every popular video in a low-cut top, and they make sure that their breasts are in focus. And this means that the top of their heads are cut off. And they figured out that if they copy the tags on the video, that their video will appear on the right side of the screen at the very top, and people will click on them because they're showing their cleavage. They've been called whores and sluts, as well as idiots. You know, a stupid person wouldn't have been able to manipulate the algorithm the way that these women had.
A writer calling himself DMV from Brooklyn found the attacks on the reply girls troubling, writing, quote, "The larger issue remains the disproportionate response of angry YouTube users calling these women derogatory names, physically threatening them, and sharing their private information as retribution. That is worse than spam. The women are neither exploiting nor forcing, but doing what YouTube allows." C.T. Paul from Connecticut agreed, saying, quote, "Who are the bigger whores, these few women trying to make a buck, or Facebook and Google, who never saw a website that they didn't want to monetize?" But Adriana Langston from Long Beach, California, points out the reply girls are problematic even for people who don't watch their videos. She says, quote, I have never seen any of these videos because I purposely avoided clicking on them. But these videos still intruded on my YouTube experience by crowding out animal-related videos that I might have actually wanted to see. Thus, some other person with a clever video of their cat riding the Roomba does not get a click from me because I never saw their video in the sidebar, and YouTube itself makes less money because I spend less time on the site. Spending less time on the site is exactly what YouTube is afraid of. A few weeks after we ran that story, we heard from YouTube, which wanted to let us and you know about changes it's making in its algorithm to make irrelevant videos less of an issue. And according to YouTube engineering director Christos Goodrow, it isn't just the reply girls causing the problem.
We have seen instances in which videos will provide something misleading in the thumbnail or the metadata. So for instance, there might be a video of someone talking about a fight, you know, a boxing match that happened, and the thumbnail has the boxing match where the guy's just getting knocked out. But if you click on the video, all you see is the person talking about that match, and there is no clip of the fight.
So how does YouTube continue to welcome the kind of back and forth conversation among video makers, but get rid of what essentially is video spam?
One way we do it is to emphasize the videos that people are watching more than the ones that they're just clicking on. And so in particular, we've recently changed the order of the recommendations we make to users to emphasize those that actually get watched over those that just get clicked. The change we made was not just in reaction to the reply girls or view count gaming. It's a broader change that actually improves the site across the board. It's one that we've been working on since last year. We don't really think of it so much in terms of fighting spam, but rather promoting good.
So if I deem cleavage to be irresistible and click on a reply girl and find out that she's just babbling nonsensically, and I abandon the video after only 4 seconds, and it's actually a 2-minute video, you'll pick that up and realize that the abandonment rate suggests lack of substance, entertainment, relevance.
That's right. It suggests lack of engagement with that video for the people who were watching the previous video. It's not just about the percent of the video they watch. It's about the amount of time they spend watching. We like to compare this to, say, shopping for a camera. You expect a salesperson to tell you which one most people purchase and use that to influence your choice. Imagine instead if customers told the store how much they liked the camera after buying it. That would make for a better recommendation, and that's what we're trying to do with the videos on YouTube.
One thing the reply girls did to game the algorithm was duplicate the tagging of the original popular video. What happens to a truly phenomenal video? Instead of just a hamster somersault, the hamster is also levitating and reciting the Gettysburg Address while in midair, right? It's a virtuosic rodent performance, but is utterly untagged and simply posted. Does it slip through the cracks at YouTube?
Well, we're trying to close those cracks as quickly as we can. It does make it more difficult. We can use all the help we can get from the uploaders and also from the community in initially tagging the video, giving it a good title that's meaningful, and also watching it. When people watch it next to other videos, then we can gather that information too to understand what the video is about and also how popular it might be. But it's a hard problem that we're working all the time to solve. How can we identify what videos are about from the information that we get on the video, from the tags, from the metadata, from the other sessions in which it gets watched, those things?
Ultimately, even though Google has about $500 billion algorithm as its primary asset, in the end, can it defeat cleavage?
Well, I don't see it really as the algorithm defeating the cleavage. What's actually happening here is the users themselves are defeating it. When the users don't watch the whole video, then all we're doing is keeping track of that information and using it to influence the next time we show that video.
I was actually thinking of posting a video myself, just entirely bare-chested. Do you think Do you think I'll be enriched as a result?
I think it depends on what you have to say while you're bare-chested.
Christos, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Christos Goodrow is engineering director at YouTube. So you're on the sofa watching basic cable at 3 a.m., and you've just seen almost 9 uninterrupted minutes of a 1993 cop thriller, so on comes the commercial break.
Are you tired of having bad credit? Easy Credit Repair can help you regain control legally and affordably.
Tax Resolution Services can help you negotiate a settlement for pennies on the dollar.
I'm Otto Williams. Would an extra $1,000 come in handy right now? Then I'd like to talk to you about Money Mutual.
Oh, Montel. But there it is. You have been transported to the desperation zone, where hard luck is the motif and salvation is but a toll-free phone call away, especially if you have the good fortune to have your bad fortune, arguably, someone else's fault.
Attention antidepressant users. The FDA has associated the use of certain antidepressants with birth defects.
If you took Celexa, Lexapro, Paxil, Effexor, Zoloft, Prozac, or Prestique.
If you or a loved one were occupationally exposed to asbestos and have been diagnosed with mesothelioma.
Warning, Accutane has been pulled from the market. Serious side effects include inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, or colitis.
If there is any category of commercial that dominates the desperation zone, it is the lawyer ad, drumming up business with alarming correlations between exposure to certain substances, usually prescription drugs, and some of the nastiest stuff ever.
If you ever took the acne drug Accutane or one of the generic versions, and you now suffer from Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, or inflammatory bowel disease, call the Relion Group now.
There was a time when TV commercials for lawyers didn't exist. They were deemed by the legal establishment to be barratry, the variously unseemly, unethical, and unlawful solicitation of clients, more commonly known as ambulance chasing. One simply did not go into public foraging for torts.
Before 1977, that would have been illegal in, I think, every state. And that had been the case for most of the 20th century.
Greg Beck is a lawyer for Public Citizen in Washington, D.C.
That changed completely in 1977 when the Supreme Court decided the case Bates versus Arizona Bar. And in that case, the Supreme Court said for the first time that the First Amendment protects lawyers in their advertisements.
If you've been injured on your job, you may need a lawyer, one who knows workers' comp and will fight hard to get you everything you're entitled to. I'm attorney Jim Sokoloff. My business is personal injury law.
Among the pioneers was Boston personal injury lawyer James Sokoloff, who thought that the law was a business like any other and could benefit from business thinking, such as expanding the marketplace. After dipping his toes in the water of print advertising, he ran a commercial aimed at victims of car crashes and then sat back waiting for the incoming. There was plenty.
We were overwhelmed with the amount of response that we received from consumers, and we were also overwhelmed by the amount of critique that we received from the organized bar.
Critiques in the form of public expressions of disdain from his more dignified peers. As his clientele grew, and as his caseload grew, and as his success rate grew, and as his fee revenue grew, the disdain substantially gave way to ad competition from or partnership with the very lawyers who had dismissed him as an embarrassment. 25 years later, his associates practice in 50 states and have accrued more than $1 billion in fees, plus perks.
Key to having spent all this money on TV advertising is I can get a reservation for dinner now, you know?
No surprise, then, that Sokoloff has many lawyers following in his footsteps. And for the faint of heart who do not wish to be seen as hucksters, advertisers such as the Relion Group troll for prospective clients, then sell the referrals to off-camera litigators. The Relion Group, a subsidiary of Lead Generation Technologies, funded by the Carlyle Group, doesn't itself employ any lawyers.
If you or a loved one have been diagnosed with bladder cancer after taking Actos, call the Relion Group now for a free legal consultation.
The question is, apart from scaring the bejeebers out of us in the middle of the night, what does tort television actually accomplish? To Elizabeth Tarbert, who regulates lawyer advertising for the Florida Bar Association, the answer is a lot. Millions of Americans who otherwise have little knowledge about, say, dubious drugs, much less the world of civil law, are provided information in the time it takes to order a ShamWow.
There may be many consumers who have no idea they may have a legal claim. So that is a purpose of lawyer advertising, is to inform consumers of their legal rights. Some people may find it distasteful, but again, we're not permitted to regulate on the grounds of taste.
On the contrary, one of the reasons all these ads look so down market is that regulators like the Florida Bar and its 49 equivalents, among them, prohibit the techniques and most of the sophistication, or at least the storytelling, seen in other categories of advertising. For instance, one Syracuse, New York lawyer had to go to federal court to protect his constitutional right to be ridiculous. Greg Beck of Public Citizen.
We represented a firm who had a variety of ads that were supposed to be funny and entertaining, including ads that sort of made the lawyers look like they were giants stomping around the city of Syracuse. And, for example, advising space aliens on personal injury claims.
Sounds like a Japanese movie from 1962.
They were kind of funny. They were silly. The bar does not like silliness, though. And it made clear that silly kinds of ads are the sorts of ads that the rule was supposed to prohibit.
Beck and his lawyer clients prevailed, but the victory provided little comfort to national advertisers like Jim Sokolov, who still must craft a single ad that will pass muster with every other jurisdiction. He began his TV advertising career using super slow-motion reenactments, and now just poses stiffly in front of a bookcase. Sokolov.
If we want to stay within regulation in all 50 states, we have to present in our media things that are very vanilla. We're dealing in a very, very restricted environment, which is not necessarily in the consumer's best interest.
There is also the question of the nation's best interests. Critics of the litigious society claim that obscene jury awards and countless nuisance lawsuits place an onerous burden on manufacturers and dedicated professionals. The counterargument, though, is that the looming threat of litigation, not to mention actual punitive damages, is a check and balance against greed and negligence. Furthermore, says Public Citizen's Beck, the courts actually aren't clogged with mesothelioma claims triggered by cable TV.
The ad is just the first contact between the lawyer and a potential client. And a lawyer has no incentive to bring a case that cannot win. And so the next thing that happens is the client contacts the lawyer and the lawyer evaluates the strength of the claim. If the lawyer at that point decides that the potential client has no case, then there's been no harm done.
Well, there's some harm done. If you're a person like, for example, me, who has seen several of his own daily medications associated with bad things. This is unnerving at 3 o'clock in the morning. For that, though, lawyer James Sokolov prescribes a remedy. It is not Zoloft, Paxil, or Celexa, which have been associated with birth defects. It's something a little more basic.
One can always turn off the message.
Really? Turn it off?
I'm not a soap star or a game show host, but I've been on TV longer than most of them. I'm attorney Jim Sokolov. Some people ask, how can he be a good lawyer if he has to advertise? The truth is...
Excellent idea.
Are you a lawyer? Has someone you don't know been victimized by mesothelioma, cancer, heart disease, kidney failure, hepatitis, stroke, migraine, depression, arthritis, asthma, or death? These are potential plaintiffs. Call 1-800-KACHING now. Parkinson's disease, Hansen's disease, Crohn's disease, Lou Gehrig disease, scurvy, gingivitis. Victims are everywhere. If you can't locate them, you may be suffering financial harm. Do not delay. Call now. You are entitled to advertise. These cases can yield large awards. Just pick up the phone. Call 1-800-KACHING now. Call 1-800-KACHING now.
This is an advertisement for advertising services. Advertising rules vary by state and jurisdiction. This is the part where I speak very, very fast. The words on your screen are too small to read. Now I'm talking even faster.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.